From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. How negotiable is a fact in nonfiction? If you're reading an essay about the suicide of a teenage boy in Las Vegas, does it matter if the essay contains some inaccurate facts? For example, if the author changed the number of strip clubs in Vegas from 31 to 34 because it fits the rhythm of the sentence better, would you care? Today we'll meet the author and the fact-checker of this very essay as we look at writing fiction versus nonfiction. Also, Jonathan Lethem talks about what he, as a novelist, is supposed to do with contemporary culture. And we'll meet the woman who's been described as the best living essayist in America, Joan Didion. She'll read from her heartbreaking memoir, Blue Nights, which chronicles the loss of her daughter, Quintana Roo. But first, William Gibson. It seems that you can't read a story about Gibson without encountering the fact that he coined the term cyberspace in his short story Burning Chrome back in 1982. He later expanded on the concept in his 1984 debut novel, Neuromancer. Neuromancer was the first winner of science fiction's Triple Crown, the Nebula Award, the Philip K. Dick Award, and the Hugo Award. Since then, Gibson's written other visionary novels. He's also written several nonfiction pieces for various publications. This nonfiction work is now collected in a new book called Distrust That Particular Flavor. In the introduction, Gibson writes that he's never felt entirely comfortable with these nonfiction pieces.
It's because I'm untrained. When I act as a journalist, I'm conscious of my own amateurism. When I write novels, I feel that I'm doing it as a professional. So I'm willing to go out there and take my chances with the critics. It took a while for me to really have my own identity as a novelist. And I think until the publication of these pieces, I never had an identity as someone who writes nonfiction. But now having published this and gone out and toured with it, I find I'm feeling more confident. They may not be fully professional, but they're whatever it is that I do when I'm given a nonfiction assignment.
Well, I have to tell you, they read like the works of a professional, so I wouldn't worry about that. But I was fascinated by your comment in the introduction that while they are certainly not fiction, they aren't quite nonfiction either. What did you mean by that?
Really, I only have the tools of a fiction writer. And those tools are never very far away. They're the only tools I have to work with on paper. And I'm sure I do things almost unconsciously that a trained journalist wouldn't do. There's a degree of coloration and conscious manipulation of texture that you wouldn't see in, say, a really good, thoroughly professional piece in the New York Times. You might see it in a piece by Tom Wolfe. People like Tom Wolfe and Hunter Thompson probably influenced me to a big degree. That sort of what was then called new journalism that would wander without announcing that it was doing it into fiction and then wander back into nonfiction.
Do you think it's important to make the distinction between the two? I mean, those were immensely readable, but you did approach them with the knowledge that not everything you were about to read was true.
Yeah, it's true.
Or maybe true isn't the right word, is it? They weren't necessarily facts.
I can't remember who said that fiction is a lie, and good fiction is a lie in which resides the truth, or words to that effect. I'm inclined to believe that.
Do you find ever the freedom from the fact checker giving you a kind of elation as you go back into fiction?
No, actually. And part of the reason The reason I don't is that the nature of my access to information has changed radically over the course of my writing career. When I began to write, if I were, say, to write a story set on the street in Cleveland, I wouldn't specify the street. And if I had to set it for some reason on a particular street in Cleveland, I would have had no visual access to that street. Today, if I'm writing a piece of fiction set in the present at some particular location in the world, I can instantly, most of the time, go and look at it on Google Street View. And I spent so much time in London via Google Street View when I was writing my most recent novel that for a year or so afterwards, I'd be talking to people and I'd say, last winter when I was in London, and then I'd realize I wasn't. Well, I was, but virtually.
Yeah. I wonder, would you be willing to read a little bit from one of the pieces in Distrust, that particular flavor for us?
Yeah, certainly. Do you have anything in mind?
Yeah, I'm really curious about the piece you wrote about Singapore for, I think it was for Wired magazine in 1993. Disneyland with a Death Penalty is the title of it.
Okay. It's like an entire country run by Jeffrey Katzenberg, the producer had said, under the motto, "Be happy or I'll kill you." We were sitting in an office a block from Rodeo Drive on large black furniture leased with Japanese venture capital. Now that I'm actually here, the Disneyland metaphor is proving impossible to shake. For that matter, Rodeo Drive comes frequently to mind, though the local equivalent feels more like 30 or 40 Beverly Centers put end to end. Was it Laurie Anderson who said that virtual reality would never look real until they learned how to put some dirt in it? Singapore's airport, the Changi Airtropolis, seemed to possess no more resolution than some early VPL world. There was no dirt whatsoever, no muss, no furred fractal edge to things. Outside, the organic, florid as ever in the tropics, had been gardened into brilliant green, and all too perfect examples of itself. Only the clouds were feathered with chaos, weird columnar structures towering above the Strait of China. The cab driver warned me about littering. He asked where I was from. He asked if it were clean there. Singapore, very clean city, he said. One of those annoying Japanese-style mechanical bells cut in as he exceeded the speed limit, just to remind us both that he was doing it. There seemed to be golf courses on either side of the freeway. "You come for golf?" he asked. "No," I said. "Business?" he asked. "Pleasure," I said. He sucked his teeth. He had his doubts about that one. Singapore is a relentlessly G-rated experience, micromanaged by a state that has the look and feel of a very large corporation. If IBM had ever bothered to actually possess a physical country, the country might have had a lot in common with Singapore. There's a certain white-shirted constraint, an absolute humorlessness in the way Singapore Limited operates. Conformity here is the prime directive, and the fuzzier brands of creativity are in extremely short supply. The physical past here has almost entirely vanished. There is no slack in Singapore. Imagine an Asian version of Zurich operating as an offshore capsule at the foot of Malaysia, an affluent microcosm whose citizens inhabit something that feels like, well, Disneyland. Disneyland with the death penalty.
It's a very vivid line. Have you ever found yourself thinking that your nonfiction has influenced your fiction?
The experience of writing the nonfiction, I realized very strongly when I was putting this book together, has often been really, really instrumental in the direction that my fiction would subsequently take, often in ways that weren't at all apparent to me when I was writing the nonfiction, and then that subsequently weren't very apparent to me when I was writing the fiction. I see bits of this prefiguring all sorts of things in the novels that I would subsequently write.
There's a case in this book of one where in the postscript you said that you thought rereading it made you almost feel as though you owed Wired an article. My Own Private Tokyo, your essay in this book.
I said that because on rereading it, I saw how much of the experience that Wired had been paying for, sending me to Tokyo for a week just so I could check it out and write something about its current state for them, which was wildly generous of them to do. So much of that experience drained off into my novel Pattern Recognition, which I wouldn't write for a year or two. But somehow it drained off and became inaccessible for the actual piece.
It's interesting you wrote there that it was the result of a kind of weird internal conflict between fiction and non. Can you explain what you meant by that?
My fiction, actually I think everyone else's fiction as well, is made up of bits and pieces of the world and of the author's life experience. I think that was as true for Tolkien as it would be for me, even though he was writing about sort of faux medieval fantasy world. He had to get it somewhere. And my function as a novelist, as I wander around the world every day, is to accumulate material. I never do it consciously. It just happens. So when I have a novel going, I'm engaged in, mostly unconsciously, in that novel all the time. And everything that comes in through the doors of perception winds up in a big hopper somewhere as potential bits and pieces of that novel. But when I attempt to do something else in the middle of that process, if I attempt to write something else, there's an interruption of the ordinary flow of things. And anything that makes it into the, in this case, the piece of nonfiction, somehow no longer belongs to the process of writing the novel. That wouldn't necessarily be true for another writer. It's just the way it seems to me to work for me.
William Gibson is the author of Distrust That Particular Flavor, his first collection of nonfiction. Do you have a favorite William Gibson novel? If you do, you can let us know what it is by sending us email through our website at ttbook.org, or you can let us know via Facebook. You'll find a link to our Facebook page on our website. It's always nice to hear from you. Coming up, a writer and a fact-checker debate how much fiction can go into a piece of nonfiction. And Jonathan Lethem talks about how a novelist like himself is supposed to deal with contemporary culture as we continue our hour on writing fiction versus nonfiction. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. How negotiable is a fact in nonfiction? If you're writing an essay, is it okay to take some artistic license with the facts to make the piece more interesting and literary? Janda Gatta thinks it is. In 2003, he wrote an essay about a 16-year-old boy named Levi Presley who committed suicide by jumping from the observation deck of the high tower of the Stratosphere Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas. The magazine that commissioned the piece rejected it due to factual inaccuracies. Degatta's essay was then accepted by another magazine. This magazine handed it over to their own fact-checker, Jim Fingal. Over the next 7 years, Degatta and Fingal went back and forth in a struggle to navigate the boundaries of literary nonfiction. The essay, along with the correspondence between the two, is now available in a book called The Lifespan of a Fact. John Degatta and Jim Fingal tell Anne Strainchamps about their experience. Here's an excerpt from their book.
Hi, John. I'm Jim Fingal. I'm the intern who's been assigned to fact-check your article about Las Vegas, and I've discovered a small discrepancy between the number of strip clubs you're claiming there are in Las Vegas and the number that's been given in your supporting documents. I'm new at this, so bear with me. I was hoping that you could clarify how you determined that there are 34 strip clubs in the city while the source you're using says 31.
Hi, Jim. I think there maybe is some sort of miscommunication because the article, as you call it, is fine. It shouldn't need a fact checker. At least that was my understanding with the editor I've been working with. I have taken some liberties in the essay here and there, but none of them are harmful. And I've actually been assuming that everyone was cool with what I turned in. But I've also given the magazine all my research so that people there could see for themselves what I was up to when I took these liberties. So I'm not sure it's going to be worth your time to fact-check this. I've been open about all these discrepancies.
I hear you, but I think it's just policy to fact-check all the nonfiction pieces the magazine publishes. Plus, it's the job I was assigned to do, so I have to do it. I've also already made a trip out there to check up on a few things in the essay because my friend was getting married and I knew this assignment was coming up. Penn and Teller say hi, by the way. So I've made a bit of investment in this myself. But really, I think they just want to make sure that all the facts in the piece add up, especially since there are a lot of them, and your claims sometimes get a little inflammatory. In a good way, of course. So could you help me out with that number?
Inflammatory?
I mean in a hard-hitting and intriguing way. Wrong choice of words, sorry.
All right. Well, from what I can remember, I got that number by counting up the number of strip clubs that were listed in the local Yellow Pages at the time of Levi's death. However, since that issue of the phone book was long gone by the time I started writing this, I found that porn article that I gave the magazine so that they could check up on my estimate.
Thanks, John. Very helpful. Now, I guess that's where the discrepancy is, because the number that's mentioned in the article is different from the number that you're using in your piece.
Well, I guess that's because the rhythm of 34 works better in that sentence than the rhythm of 31, so I changed it.
Ah, okay. Well, thanks for your time, John. I'll probably be checking back with you later on.
Well, that turned out to be the understatement of the year, didn't it, Jim? You checked back with John several dozen times over the next, 7 years?
Yeah.
So here you are dealing with this whole new beast, and John says he had, quote-unquote, taken liberties. What kind of liberties did you discover John had taken?
You know, numbers massaged, quotations streamlined, sentences that sort of stretched the limits of interpretations of the source material.
What did you think, for instance, of John's comment that he had changed the number of strip clubs from 31 to 34 because he liked the rhythm of 34 better?
That sort of thing was hard for me to really approach. A lot of what, you know, one does as a fact checker is you either personally verify something or you consult a trusted source, a book or an article in the newspaper. I guess in the realms of counting strip clubs in a phone book, you get in the realms of ephemera where there's not really any practical way I could verify that. So the author himself is my only real source for that. So very quickly started butting up against the wall of unverifiability.
Hmm. And John, for you, this whole approach grew out of a much larger philosophy about the kind of piece you were writing. you don't necessarily see yourself as writing journalism. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't consider myself a journalist. I've never received training as a journalist. I guess my last few projects, however, have just been initiated by a journalistic approach. I don't even know what that means. I know that I do an overwhelming amount of research and I'm often interviewing people. But what I then do with the information is dramatically different. But I also like, much in this essay and in the book from which this essay was excerpted, I like playing with the idea of journalism and our expectations of journalism. So I like making something feel journalistic and then slowly reveal that that approach isn't really going to give us as readers what we want from the text, that we need to try a different sort of essaying. And then the essays become a lot more associative and they perhaps become a bit more imaginative and start taking the problematic liberties.
Would you guys mind reading another exchange?
Sure. Hey, John, again. I was wondering if you could weigh in on this tic-tac-toe game with the chicken. It looks like it happened quite a bit after Levi Presley died, but also that the woman who won it wasn't really from Mississippi. I think she was a local resident. Does that matter?
I realize that, but I need her to be from a place other than Las Vegas in order to underscore the transient nature of the city, that nearly everyone in Vegas is from someplace else. And since she did in fact originally come from Mississippi, I think the claim is fine as it is.
What about the fact that this didn't occur on the day Presley died? It's not accurate to say that it did.
It was part of the atmosphere of that particular summer.
Then isn't that how it should be framed so that it's more accurate?
No, because being more precise would be less dramatic and would sound a lot clunkier. I don't think readers will care whether the events that I'm discussing happened on the same day, a few days apart, or a few months apart. What most readers will care about, I think, is the meaning that's suggested in the confluence of these events, no matter how far apart they occurred. The facts that are being employed here aren't meant to function baldly as facts. The work that they're doing is more image-based than informational. Nobody's going to read this, in other words, in order to get a survey of the demographics of Las Vegas or what's scheduled on the community calendar. Readers can get that kind of information elsewhere.
A little later in the exchange, when you're both getting a little testier with each other, John, you suggest, I'm quoting here, that at some point the reader needs to stop demanding they be spoon-fed like infants. And you later say that we've become like adolescents with art. I guess I'm curious about how is it that we've become like children about art?
Well, that's a great question. I think for me, it goes back to those expectations that we have as readers for this genre that we've started calling nonfiction, but one that we've only started calling nonfiction over the past 50 or 60 years. When you label something like that, you approach it with the expectation that what you're getting in it is going to be something that you can trust. And in fact, it's that issue of trust that often comes up when, you know, it's revealed that some very popular memoir may have invented a bit of personal history. And we hear from readers in response to those revelations that they feel betrayed. They feel that they invested some trust, some faith in this writer and that they betrayed them. And that's problematic to me because we ought to be able to trust our politicians. We ought to be able to trust our lovers. We ought to be able to trust, you know, maybe even the companies we do business with. But that's not the right relationship, I would say, or it's not the kind of relationship we should expect to have with art. I think it's actually art's job to trick us. I think it's art's job to lure us into terrain that is going to confuse us or make us feel uncomfortable and perhaps open up to us possibilities in the world that we hadn't earlier considered. I think that we have to be fooled before we're really able to wonder. So philosophically, my issue is that we're not allowing an entire genre, nonfiction, to have that kind of relationship with a reader. And that's, for me, as an artist, that's problematic.
Jim, did your ideas about fact and fiction shift or change at all as you went through the fact-checking process with John?
Well, I think the biggest thing for me was the distancing and a little bit of alienation from this concept of genre, because the genres of fiction and nonfiction and the essay are all man-made things. They're sort of circles that we draw around different types of writing, and there's a porousness between their borders. Through fact-checking the piece, I think the assumptions that I brought to what a piece like this, by calling it nonfiction or by calling it an essay, what that meant, it drew out to me the meaning of the act of calling it by one of those names.
John, how about you? Did that experience change anything about the way you write nonfiction?
A little bit. I think I'm a little more willing to acknowledge that there is a line somewhere that one shouldn't cross. But at the same time, I would still insist that it's a line that only we as individual writers can draw. Only we can determine where it is. But that we should look for it. We should be on the lookout for moments when we might be overstepping what's appropriate.
John DeGatta is the author of The Lifespan of a Fact, and Jim Fingal is the fact checker. They spoke with Ann Strangechamps. What do you think about the idea of writers taking liberties with facts when they write nonfiction? You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org or drop us a line via Facebook. It's always nice to hear from you. What is a novelist supposed to do with contemporary culture? And what is contemporary culture supposed to do with novelists? These are among the questions that novelist Jonathan Lethem explores in his new collection of nonfiction, The Ecstasy of Influence, Nonfictions, etc. Lethem talked to Steve Paulson about the novelist's role in modern culture.
By making it sound so objective, it sounds like I have any idea what other novelists should do. And really what I mean is, how do I cope with this sort of antiquated role that I've assigned myself when so many people are claiming the novel is dead or irrelevant, and I myself feel it's very vital, but, you know, I don't want to entrench in some sort of rear guard action and think that I'm embattled. It feels very vital to me and very connected to the culture at large. And so I'm really trying to lay a lot of track for my evidence, which is that I'm myself very eager to talk about contemporary stuff and the novel and their relationship, and I don't see any real obstacles to that.
Okay, well, let me play the devil's advocate for a moment here. It would seem that reading is becoming, if not a marginal activity, at least a less popular one these days, and it's harder for a novelist to make his or her mark on the culture. What makes you say that the novel is still vital in American culture?
Well, yeah, I know it's very much the received wisdom that we're on the ropes, but I'll just try to pick apart some of your terms at their source. I think when I lived in the Bay Area in the late 80s and early 90s, and everyone was getting all revved up about virtual reality and the internet, there was this notion that it was going to just kind of destroy all previous forms of cultural transmission, all other modes and genres and mediums. Yet here we are, and what I see happening is that we all go online all the time when we write letters to one another. It's like an epistolary medium. We all read essays and argue about things. And a lot of what we argue about are these ostensibly dead forms, like the play we saw last night or the novel that we read the other day. I've just tended to feel that actually the novel has an incredibly vibrant and persistent space in the life of the culture, and that the myth of its death or the fact that it's imperiled seems quite silly. It's something that we like to say because it's a way of expressing a kind of anxiety we have about contemporary reality. But when people are reading novels, they're in a unique transmission between the author and their own sensibility. And I don't think that's available in any other medium.
Do you think the job of the novelist has changed over, I don't know, the last 20 or 30 years ago? I mean, have the aesthetic demands of what it means to be a novelist, do they mean something different now than they used to?
Well, I sort of suspect that the differences are overstated. And what we end up with is a kind of received impression of the past where there's this titanic power invested in the novel and novelists. And sure, I mean, I do remember when I was growing up that Gore Vidal and Norman Mailer, you know, were on TV punching each other all the time, and it seemed like they could be on the cover of news weeklies and that they had this immense power. But the actual art of the novel tends to be advanced at another level, and it moves a little more quietly. It moves among readers. It moves among novelists. And the fact that every now and then one of us gets sort of thrown up as a kind of a mythic figure is an interesting ritual, but it doesn't seem to me essential to the operation.
But I'm wondering also, especially for a younger writer coming up, if you kind of feel like you need to write a different kind of novel than, I don't know, Philip Roth or John Updike used to write.
Well, I don't know. I mean, Philip Roth had a famous essay, I guess, in the 70s about the difficulty the novel had keeping up with contemporary reality, that the news was outstripping it. And this piece gets written and rewritten, and it's an interesting anxiety, I think a worthwhile anxiety for novelists to engage in, that they can't find a way to encompass or incorporate or connect to the breaking news, the frontier of new media or, more kind of vernacular cultural materials that are a little more light on their feet. But in fact, that job of incorporating and responding to and finding a way to engulf all of the stuff is the novelist's work. And you see it happening again and again, and it starts to become normal, and then you don't remark on it anymore. I remember when the argument was made that it was impossible for the novel to do anything with rock and roll. Rock and roll was sort of too vernacular, too brisk, too surprising, and the novel was too ponderous to deal with it, and this was meant to be something you couldn't do. Well, Jennifer Egan just won the Pulitzer Prize for a rock and roll novel, and no one seems to see any obstruction at all anymore. Now, perhaps if you wrote a novel that incorporated video games or too much of the life of social media, it might seem that there was some sort of static or resistance in the mix. But in another 20 or 30 years, this will seem ordinary and seamless because the novelist does engage with contemporary culture. It's not a quarantine. It's actually a kind of rolling frontier.
Well, it sounds like you're also saying that that old distinction between high and low culture is, if not entirely gone, disappearing, especially when it comes to fiction writers.
Oh, yeah. I always think that high and low culture are easy to mention, but very hard to actually put your finger on when you begin to identify what you mean. The novel itself was low culture. It was a pop form. It was seen as something for women to read when they were killing time at home while serious literary writers worked on and read essays or poetry. So the novel has no special purchase on being highbrow culture. In fact, it's an indigenous form that always is roving and moving between different layers of cultural materials, or I think it ought to be anyway.
Well, you write about some of these issues in one of your essays called Against Pop Culture. And I'm wondering if you could read the beginning of that essay.
Sure, you bet. In the termite phase of my career, the term pop culture made sense to me. It seemed an approximate cover for loose bushels of enthusiasms, rock and roll, movies, comics, science fiction, and crime writing. Once I got lashed to the mast of my private canon, the word pop looked squishier and squishier to me, and lately I seem to want to blow it up whenever it's offered to me. Pop music or pop art, fair enough. These seemed specific enough to matter, but pop culture seemed like a password to a clubhouse, for those who identified, and a term of quarantine for those championing what they believed remained outside or above the radioactive area. The snobbish grudge against pop culture was that those who cared for it cared for all of it equally, and the problem was that this grudge was too often justified in the values suspended veil of fandom. Having admitted to seeing Star Wars too many times as a 13-year-old, should I have to subsequently pretend I thought the movie was much good? Once a decade of Kurosawa, Hawks, Kubrick, and Lang had straightened out my thinking? Couldn't I talk about comics as an intoxicant while expressing exhaustion at the measly narrative or visual chops in the 70s comics that had intoxicated me? Well, I could try, but I wouldn't necessarily be heard. The superb critic John Leonard, as much a personal hero of my teenage years as Leonard Nimoy, acting precisely in the role of the notorious gray eminence from David Foster Wallace's E Unibus Plurum essay, spanked my cumulative life's work in the New York Review of Books for being uncritically pegged on iconography he found wearisome. The same month, another man named John Leonard devoted his television column in New York Magazine to defending the 70s television program Kojak against the insult of an inferior remake. Except it was the same John Leonard. My fetish is okay, yours not so okay.
That is great. Thank you very much.
Sure.
You have an interesting comment in the preface to this collection of essays. You say that your efforts as a writer to make what you see in your mind's eye visible in the reader's mind's eye, and you write about negotiating selfhood in a world of other selves, the permanent trouble of being alive. What do you mean there?
Every other form of inquiry that I'm really responsive to myself, philosophy, neurological research, media studies, tends to point, I mean, for that matter, particle physics, which I barely can understand, but I do keep my eye on the fact that, like so many other kinds of inquiry, the discovery is greater mystery, greater complexity, more reflexivity, fewer simple answers. And I do think that, you know, we live in a culture that in a lot of cases wants things to be very simple. And it can be seductive for a writer or for any kind of artist to, I don't know, claim to reside in some range of very pure description or expressivity. I'm not an intellectual or I'm not self-conscious. I just make these descriptions. I write down what I see. You know, I paint what I see, son. I paint what I see. But in fact, to enter into the realm of consciousness and language is to move into an extremely ticklish area where everything does redouble upon itself and get more complex, because the mind itself, even the solitary mind, is immensely intricate and contradictory and paradoxical place to be. And then when you realize that every person you're dealing with is subject to the same immense complications of negotiating a conscious life, well, what can our job possibly be as novelists except to describe this complexity as fully as we can and not to somehow make short shrift of it or flinch from the extraordinary complexity of language and mind? So we've got to become encompassing in that way to even remotely keep up with what's out there.
Now, as a writer, you really wear two hats, probably wear more than that, actually. But, I mean, the obvious ones are you're a novelist, and you also are a critic. I mean, you write a lot of critical essays. I mean, you've just released this large collection of critical essays. Do you approach those two endeavors in a similar way, or are they really two different mindsets?
I was making stories and novels for a long time before I ever tried anything that anyone would call criticism. And even when I began to write essays or do a few reviews of other people's books, I tended to approach it as a fiction writer would. It was a kind of assignment in inventing a voice and a set of terms, a set of parameters for describing something and making it come to life. And I found there was no way in for me except to use personal experience and my storytelling nerves to make it come to life. I couldn't do it otherwise. So I don't see them as separate at all. Most of my essays, most of my reviews are, in my mind, short stories about a writer trying to figure out what they think of something, basically.
Jonathan Leatham is the author of The Ecstasy of Influence, Nonfictions, etc. He spoke with Steve Paulson. If you have questions or comments about the program, we'd love to hear from you. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. You'll also find a link to our Facebook page there. Coming up, one of the modern masters of American prose, Joan Didion, as we conclude our hour on writing fiction and nonfiction. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We've been looking at writing fiction versus nonfiction in this hour, so what better way to finish than to hear from someone who has excelled at writing both fiction and nonfiction, Joan Didion. Didion helped popularize creative nonfiction with her essay collections Slouching Towards Bethlehem and The White Album. In her 2005 book, The Year of Magical Thinking, Didion wrote about her grief after the sudden death of her husband, John Gregory Dunn. The book won the National Book Award. Less than 2 years after her husband died, Didion lost her daughter, Quintana Roo. Roo had been very ill, even before her father's death. Didion writes about this tragedy in her new book, Blue Nights. She spoke to Steve Paulson and read an excerpt from Blue Nights.
When I began writing these pages, I believed they're subject to be children, the ones we have and the ones we wish we had. The ways in which we depend on our children to depend on us. The ways in which we encourage them to remain children. The ways in which they remain more unknown to us than they do to their most casual acquaintances. The ways in which we remain equally opaque to them. The ways in which our investments in each other remain too freighted ever to see the other clear. The ways in which neither we nor they can bear to contemplate the death or the illness or even the aging of the other. As the pages progressed, it occurred to me that their actual subject was not children after all, at least not children per se, at least not children qua children. Their actual subject was this refusal even to engage in such contemplation, this failure to confront the certainties of aging, illness, and death. This fear. Only as the pages progressed further did I understand that the two subjects were the same. When we talk about mortality, we are talking about our children. Hello, Quintana. I'm going to lock you here in the garage. After I became five, I never dreamed about him. Once she was born, I was never not afraid. I was afraid of swimming pools, high-tension wires, lie under the sink, aspirin in the medicine cabinet, the broken man himself. I was afraid of rattlesnakes, riptides, landslides, strangers who appeared at the door, unexplained fevers, elevators without operators, and empty hotel corridors. The source of the fear was obvious. It was the harm that could come to her. A question. If we and our children could in fact see the other clear, would the fear go away? Would the fear go away for both of us, or would the fear go away only for me?
Wow, thank you so much. One of the questions that runs throughout your book is whether you had done enough for your daughter, Quintana. Did you protect her? Did you care enough for her? Did you love her enough? As you say, at one point, was I the problem? And I'm wondering if you worried about those things throughout her life, or whether these questions mainly have taken on importance after she died?
No, I think I worried about them all through her life. I think that I was the problem. Worrying was my default mode.
Why did you worry so much about whether you were a good enough mother?
I think probably a lot of it had to do with Quintana was adopted. I had this very strong sense that I had been handed out of the blue, this perfect child. I could never be up to the task. So yes, I think probably, as I say, that I was a lot of the problem.
Now, do you think it was because Quintana seemed so perfect when you got her, or was it more kind of the kind of person you've been, sort of, you know, this very successful writer, you know, with a very successful career? And did you sort of wonder whether you were just sort of mother material?
Before Quintana was born, before she came to live with me, which she did the day after she was born, I assumed that I was mother material. It was only when I had to face the reality of actually having the perfect baby in my arms that I kind of felt not up to it.
Hmm. Now, one reviewer has described this book as not so much a memoir of grief as your last book, The Year of Magical Thinking, was, but more a memoir of regret. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
I think that's a fair assessment also. I don't think it's so much about grief at all. I think a lot of it is about personal failure. I don't mean just my personal failure, but everybody in the story, as it were, fails to do what they wish they could do.
Which is so fascinating to hear, because anyone who sort of knows of you from the outside knows that You've had one of the most celebrated careers of any American writer. You are extremely well-connected. You've written Hollywood screenplays. Then to hear you talk about failure, about everyone's failure, that will...
But doesn't everybody feel themselves to be a failure at some level? Or very few people perceive themselves as being unalloyed successes. If they do, they probably ought to think again.
But a lot of people don't want to look there. I mean, I guess that's the thing that's striking about your book is, you know, a lot of people will do anything to cover up those doubts.
Well, but you can't, can you, in the end? We all have doubts and we all live with them, whether we admit it or not. My sense of those doubts is that you're better off admitting them. You're better off looking them straight in the eye.
I read somewhere that you nearly gave up writing this memoir sort of halfway through. Is that true?
I did, because it was much harder to do. Maybe you don't notice this at first, but it's an entirely different tone from magical thinking, which had been very easy to write. And I didn't have a lot of confidence that I was getting it right.
Why did you need to write this book differently than the book about your husband's death?
I just had the sense that it required a different tone. Magical thinking was an exploration of raw grief. And it was fairly straightforward. This is what it's like to look up at the dinner table one night and your husband is dead. And I felt very strongly that it was necessary for me to tell that in a very direct way. This wasn't so direct.
What was the hardest part of writing this book?
Well, I think finding that tone was a hard part, and coming to the realization that it was not about children, as I say at some point in it, that it was not, or at least it was not about children per se, it was about death. Or it wasn't about death per se, it was about getting older, it was about things we don't like to necessarily focus on.
Which is so interesting because, I mean, what you're really saying is that your daughter's death, I mean, your daughter who died at the age of 39, somehow that has, you almost can't separate that from your own process of getting older and of, I presume, thinking about your own death.
Well, it's not so much my own death. I don't think it's my own death. I think it is getting older. No matter how much we think we are right on top of our own aging process, most of us really aren't. We think about anything except getting older. Even when I was deep into this book, which had clearly become about getting older, I found it hard to say how old I actually was. That was a stunning moment when I actually wrote it down. I mean, a stunning moment for me.
Joan Didion is the author of Blue Nights. She spoke with Steve Paulson. Here's Didion reading another passage from the book.
I no longer want reminders of what was, what got broken, what got lost, what got wasted. There was a period, a long period, dating from my childhood until quite recently, when I thought I did. A period during which I believed that I could keep people fully present, keep them with me, by preserving their mementos, their things, their totems. The detritus of this misplaced belief now fills the drawers and closets of my apartment in New York. There is no drawer I can open without seeing something I do not want on reflection to see. There is no closet I can open with room left for the clothes I might actually want to wear. In one closet that might otherwise be put to such use, I see instead three old Burberry raincoats of John's, a suede jacket given to Quintana by the mother of her first boyfriend, and an Angora cape long since moth-eaten given to my mother by my father not long after World War II. In another closet I find a chest of drawers, a perilously stacked assortment of boxes. I open one of the boxes. I find photographs taken by my grandfather when he was a mining engineer in the Sierra Nevada, in the early years of the 20th century. In another of the boxes, I find the scraps of lace and embroidery that my mother had salvaged from her own mother's boxes of mementos. the jet beads, the ivory rosaries, all the objects for which there is no satisfactory resolution. In the third of the boxes, I find skein after skein of needlepoint yarn, saved in the eventuality that remedial stitches might ever be required on a canvas completed and given away in 2001. In the chest of drawers, I find papers written by Quintana when she was still at the Westlake School for Girls, the research study on stress, the analysis of Angel Clare's role in Tessa's d'Urbervilles. I find her Westlake summer uniforms. I find her navy blue gym shorts. I find the blue and white pinafore she wore for volunteering at St. John's Hospital in Santa Monica. I find the black wool chalet dress I bought her when she was 4 at Bendel's on West 57th Street. When I bought that black wool chalet dress, Bendel's was still on West 57th Street. It was that long ago. Bendel's became, after Geraldine Stutz stopped running it, just another store. But when it was still on West 57th Street and I bought that dress, it was special. It was everything I wanted either one of us to wear. It was all Holly's Harp chiffon and lettuce edges in sizes 0 and 2. Other objects for which there is no satisfactory resolution. I continue opening boxes. I find more faded and cracked photographs than I want ever again to see. I find many engraved invitations to the weddings of people who are no longer married. I find many mass cards from the funerals of people whose faces I no longer remember. In theory, these mementos serve to bring back the moment. In fact, they serve only to make clear how inadequately I appreciated the moment when it was here. How inadequately I appreciated the moment when it was here is something else I can never afford to see.
Joan Didion reading an excerpt from Blue Nights. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of the program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program Writing Fiction versus Nonfiction. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Ann Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.